Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're watching and listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. My guest today is Brad Olson. Brad will be talking about his new book. Brad is an acknowledged expert on all things Antarctica. This is a subject that I am deeply interested in. So without any further ado, Brad Olson, welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Hey James, thanks for having me on the Cosmic Switchboard. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And yep, the new book just came out as of January 1st, so only about a week in the pipeline. But happy to go over all the secrets of Antarctica with you today.
Yeah, please tell us how your labor of love got kindled. Well, what about Antarctica? And tell us a bit about your background for our listeners who don't, and viewers who don't know. What pulled you in this direction, and what perhaps interesting anomalous experiences you had growing up, that kind of nudged you in this direction as well. The floor is yours.
Sure. Well, I'm a lifetime world traveler. In my 20s, I taught English in Japan and self-financed all my trips. But this particular time in my 20s, I paid for a trip throughout Asia, Australia, back up to India, Nepal, and Europe again, and also Egypt. So I had two continents to go, South America and Antarctica. So 7 years ago, I had a rent-controlled apartment in San Francisco, and a new owner of the building was moving in, and I got the boot, no fault eviction of my own. So when life gives you lemons, you make lemonade. And I thought there's a great opportunity to go to South America and Antarctica. So 7 years ago, my girlfriend at the time, I bought a vehicle in Santiago, Chile. We drove up to Peru and joined a tour with Nassim Harriman and Brian Forrester in Peru and Bolivia, and then struck down all the way through Argentina to the southernmost city in the world, which is Ushuaia, Argentina. And there we gained passage on a sailboat to Antarctica. It was really quite extraordinary experience, although I have to say it was probably the hardest trip of my life, crossing the Drake Passage and getting violently seasick. But that's when we set our sights on Antarctica, pulling in on the sailboat, and got to step foot on terra firma and be able to say I visited the frozen ice continent.
I've heard, and I could be wrong because I don't really know much about it. It doesn't seem like you had much difficulty gaining passage from the tip of South America. Are there like difficulties or hurdles if someone wants to come from the United States or some other means to get to Antarctica?
Yeah, that's the common belief, but it's actually not entirely true. You can travel there. In fact, it even states specifically in the Antarctica Treaty, which was ratified in the late 1950s, that the whole continent would be open to scientific research and tourism. But there are places you're not allowed to go. There are no-fly zones. But where we went is kind of the tourist corridor, I'd say, because there were a lot of other cruise ships that were in that area and other private sailboats too. So what we had to do prior to leaving Ushuaia, Argentina, we had to go to the Argentinian naval office there and basically submit our itinerary and also everybody's passports. So they had that. And that's actually a good thing in case something went wrong. You'd want them to know where you're at if you had to call out an SOS, because boy, if you go down in the Southern Ocean, you've got a matter of minutes to live if you hit the water. It's very, very cold. Hypothermia sets in quick. So then the same day, we actually went to the customs office at the pier where all the cruise ships leave from, and we got stamped out of Argentina after being stamped in when we entered that particular part of Tierra del Fuego. And so that was the weirdest thing, James, is that for 26 days, we were stamped out with no other location. and got stamped back into Argentina once we arrived. So it's kind of this no man's land of 26 days with no date on our passports.
Missing time facet to the passport stamping.
There we go.
You passed through Argentina because it's intimately connected with Antarctica and the Fourth Reich, so-called. Did you come across any of those German settlements or places that really look Germanic as far as architecture, streets, people, when you were going through South America?
Yeah, definitely in South America. We did not get anywhere near New Schwabenland in Antarctica. But Antarctica is a huge continent, as you know. It's like twice the size of Australia, where you're at. And going down there, though, yeah, I did make it part of my itinerary to go to a couple of these so-called Fourth Reich micronation headquarters or large landowning. The first was La Falda, which is outside the second largest city in Argentina, Cordoba, up in the Cordoba Sierra mountain range. A lot of people don't know there's a secondary mountain range in Argentina outside the Andes. And in these, it's a much smaller mountain range, but up in these hills of is the town of La Falda, and it is very Germanic. I mean, you see signs for Wiener Schnitzel and Strudel. You can go in for a stein of German beer in some of the pubs. And we went to the La Falda Hotel, which was actually very infamous for housing Adolf Hitler after the war. So I took the tour of the Eden Hotel, which was like the Biltmore of Argentina, very, very high-end hotel. And I fortunately the tour guide could speak English pretty well. And at the end of the trip, I said, "Do you really think Hitler survived the war?" He goes, "Well, I don't have to think, I know it." I said, "How do you know it?" He says, "Right here in town, there is an elderly woman who was a teenager in the late 1940s, and she was a chambermaid in the Eden Hotel, and she virtually remembers that Hitler and Eva Braun, even their dog Blondie, survived the war, and she saw him. And she's even taken lie detector tests and passed them every time that she witnessed Hitler alive." So he kind of moved around locations. There's a History Channel show called Hunting Hitler that went for 3 seasons on the History Channel. And of course, they did one or two episodes on La Falda. And they also did some episodes on San Carlos di Bariloche. And that too, and I've been to Germany many times, James, and you go to Bariloche and it's like, wow, I'm in a barbarian town in the foothills of the Alps again. Very Germanic and very wealthy. So there's a joke in South America, especially in Chile and Argentina, where they've lost almost all their indigenous people. There's only about 1% left. And they're kind of going through an existential crisis. Who are we as Argentinians? And most of them come from Southern Europe, the Italians, the Spanish, the Greeks. So the joke is, well, we're Italians who speak Spanish and wish we're as rich as the Germans, because the Germans have all the wealth down there still to this day.
Bring that up because of the inextricable connection with Antarctica. From your perspective and your research, when did the Germans first make it down there, and were they the first Europeans that we know of that went down there? And tie it in, if you will, because I can't. When I think of the South Pole and Antarctica, I can't help but think about the North Pole, Hyperborea. I don't know if that story relates to the Southern Pole as well as the Northern, but then we have Admiral Byrd's story, supposedly that he had some kind of experience in the North Pole too. So I don't want to go all over, the map North and South Pole wise, but to me it all seems connected because it's all the same planet anyway. So your thoughts about Antarctica and what connection, if any, it has with Admiral Byrd's prior, well, before he was an admiral in North Pole, and then eventually, post World War II, what happened down there?
Yeah, well, a pretty open-ended question. Might take me a few minutes to explain, but the Germans were among the first to go down there. Admiral Byrd had made several expeditions in the 1920s. In fact, he was the very first aviator to fly over the South Pole. And on that trip, I would say, James, he spotted the giant hole in the ice because I have in my book the actual flight route that he took. And here's the blow up of when he gets to South America. You'd think once he got to the pole, you do a little fist bump. Yeah, we made it. But what does he do? He goes about 100 miles out of his way to circle around this area of the South Pole. And it turns out that happens to be the exact location where they have the no-fly zone, where no flights are allowed to go. It's called the clean air sector. So you see on the blow-up map of Antarctica, he went right over the no-fly zone, over the clean air sector. And I also talked to Brian S., who was a whistleblower for Linda Moulton Howe, and he flew over and saw the hole. This is his map where you can see hole in the ice. And all three of those maps exactly point to the same area outside of the South Pole station where this presumed hole in the ice is. So to me, that's the smoking gun. That Byrd saw it and he flew back there, one of the first flights of Operation High Jump in late 1946 when he had the 3 hours of missing time, and he knew that the hole was big enough to drop in and explore this area. And what he found, he describes in his diary as a high-tech city located below the ice. So I think there was actually civilization there prior to Byrd and the Germans and everybody else getting down there, but the Germans allied themselves with the domain of the Ariane and built their new Berlin base, actually a science city, according to Captain Mark Richards, located very close to this South Pole hole in the ice and this domain of the Ariane, which they called a paradise on Earth. And incidentally, Admiral Byrd also called it a paradise on Earth. And you'd think, geez, underneath the ice in Antarctica, that's got to just be a frozen wasteland. But no, they both call it paradise. And it was Admiral Dolenz who said that we have created for the Fuhrer an impregnable fortress in one of the most remote locations on Earth, Shangri-La, he called it, under the ice, presumably in Antarctica. But you also mentioned the North Pole or Greenland, which was the historic homeland of Hyperborea, as well as the Thule base in northern Greenland, which is still a US base today. And this is what now Trump is saying, we got to claim Greenland for this very reason. So that's kind of interesting too.
When Byrd flew into the large cavity or hole the first time, what were the surroundings and the environment like? Because I'm only going by memory, the bits and pieces that I've read. I'll definitely plug into your book as well. But I heard stories about like it was warmer, that there was flora and fauna, that was ve there was vegetation. The
Yeah.
more he went in, could you describe that?
Yeah, absolutely. So in his diary, and I'll paraphrase here, but he basically is only allowed to fly with one person, his radio man named Howie, and they drop in to the hole, and once they get down to the continental level, they're very surprised to see a verdant green landscape. Now, how it could get the sun to make plants grow, I don't know. And also, they're flying through it. They're seeing these rolling green hills. And then they say, hey, is that an elephant? Wait a minute. Upon closer examination, that's a woolly mammoth. So, even pre-ice age mammals, megaflora, megafauna down there And they keep flying, they're going along, and then all of a sudden Bird loses control of his plane. And but the instruments are still working, and the handle is flying remote controlled. And then over the radio, they also lose contact with Little America. Overcomes a voice, a Germanic voice that says, "Hello, Admiral Byrd, you are in good hands. We will be landing in the domain shortly. Just relax." And when they get to this city under the ice, they land like a helicopter. And wingtip to wingtip are two UFOs he describes as Flugelrods. But there is no such word in the German language. But he describes them as typical UFOs with German insignia on them as well. So it really leaves little to the imagination that what they experienced were perhaps one of the Hanibu or Vril craft that the Germans were working on pre-World War II. Give you an example of what they looked like, because they were very well advanced in their research on these UFOs and many different prototypes, from very small early editions, the Vril craft, to the very large that could actually leave Earth's atmosphere. And I think if history were really to tell the truth, the Germans were the first on the moon, the Germans were the first on Mars. And they set up bases in both of those locations. So, with this very advanced technology, they were actually able to leave the planet, the breakaway civilization we've heard so much about, too.
Ariadne, you describe them? Because to me, they sound almost like a human-looking group, maybe perhaps even Nordic in appearance. And how were they described?
Yeah, he did describe them, too. So, when they landed there, these two very tall, blonde, Germanic-looking pilots came out, but they had German or Nordic accents. In fact, when they flew out 3 hours later, the last thing they said over the radio to Admiral Byrd was "Auf Wiedersehen," which means goodbye in German. So they're actually speaking in German part of the time in English. But when he met the master in the domain of the Ariane, he asked, why did you want to see me? And the master says, "Well, you're very well known on the surface of the planet." And Admiral Byrd was thinking in his head, "Surface? Where am I?" And the master was telepathic, could read his thoughts, and says, "Yes, you're below, at least below the ice level in the inner Earth realms." And so this was just mind-blowing to Admiral Byrd. Now, mind you, this is still during Operation High Jump, one of the first flights he took. When he got back, the last survivor of High Jump, his name's Robert Johnson, and just a couple years ago, he broke his non-disclosure agreement to talk about what he experienced down there with Admiral Byrd in High Jump. And he said when Byrd came back from that flight, that he was very shaken. Didn't want to talk about it, didn't even fill out a flight log for the trip, which is very uncharacteristic of him, and basically told Robert Johnson, "You were there with me in High Jump. Don't forget what we saw," meaning that they had seen something extraordinary, even just on the expeditions outside of this flight, because Robert Johnson reported landing party to explore around the Neuschwabenland area, and they saw this crack in the ice that was perfectly symmetrical and ran for miles, just a perfect straight line. And there was hot air coming out from it. And below, they could hear a slight humming sound, like some kind of machinery or a city down there. So they knew that the Nazis were very well entrenched in Antarctica. And the whole reason for High Jump was to dislodge the Germans from their redoubt and also to come back with some captured craft. Unfortunately, High Jump netted neither of those results, and they had to leave 2 months into the 6 month expedition.
And the stories that's come down is that the high jump armada was attacked. Can you get into that? And if so, by who? By the Ariane, or I suppose the Ariane is the name of the advanced race there, or at least one of them. And then, or were they attacked by the Germans? Please, the floor is yours.
Yeah, well, that's the topic for the cover of the book, the Battle of Antarctica, or the Battle of High Jump, it's called. And yet these craft, which were pretty much like the Honeyboot craft, I would say, and it's not entirely known whether it was an ET race, whether it was the Ariane, or whether it was German backward engineered craft. But nonetheless, the Germans did have very advanced craft and were testing it during World War II, and then got it all out of there before the end of the war. And so it probably was German craft, because they came up out of the water and out of holes in the ice and attacked one of the branches of the Armada and sunk one ship, just one. They could have taken out the whole fleet, but instead they just took out one ship, the USS Maddox, in a show of force, and knocked out just about all the planes too. And then Byrd says, "We're calling this thing off. We're out of here." 2 months into the 6 month expedition, with unlimited funding from the Navy, in an expedition that he called military by nature in a press conference before high jump. So they were going down there with an invasion force to try to knock out the German colony down there, but to no avail.
Drew my attention watching some of your discussions about the work that Russian researchers have done. For example, this one individual, he had access to some of the archival material that the Soviet Red Army had scooped up at German naval headquarters and German army headquarters, et cetera. Can you delve into some of that? And what was, if you could remind my listeners, what was the name of that researcher, that Russian guy that you turned me on to?
Oh yeah, I mean, this has just been, again, this is like a smoking gun, because there was this Russian researcher who acquired the U-boat maps that were made for all the U-boat captains, including very detailed diving instructions to Agartha. It says they're right there in German. This is an original direction map, and we translated in English the diving instructions that must be strictly followed. And he came up with several different versions of maps that show how and where to dive under the ice, and you arrive at certain lakes that are under the ice, and then you dive again to get to the lighthouse of Agartha. And so my research assistant Frank, he charted it out. He charted the route from the German instructions on the U-boat map. And sure enough, it comes within 100 miles of the South Pole. So there's even U-boat directions to get under the ice to the domain of the Ariane, or within 100 miles of it. So another thing I need to point out here, James, is that Antarctica is the most volcanically active continent in the world. There's 14 known volcanoes and 93 known geothermal vents. So you have the propensity to open up large under ice domes that could go on for 100 miles or more. And so that's why I think the hole in the ice is like a chimney. It's a heat exhaust vent to allow this geothermal heat to escape. So back to Nikolai Subotin. He's this Russian researcher. Right after the Berlin Wall fell and the Soviet Union collapsed in the early 1990s, researchers were going to Moscow with a suitcase full of hard currency or gold, silver, and they could buy whatever they were looking for from the KGB. They would just, "What do you want? Alien autopsy video, UFO crash." All that stuff is now on the internet. But also, a lot of the KGB files that they acquired from Germany at the end of World War II. Because keep in mind, the Soviet Red Army, they were the first to Berlin and to Dresden and these cities that had the high command of all the fighting forces, as well as the Annenerbe Society. So the Annenerbe were collecting all this documentation about their ancient ancestors. That's what Annenerbe means, the study of our ancestors. And they believed that they were connected to this high-tech civilization in the earth. The Aryans, the Ariani, I mean, the name is almost identical. And so they were sending these trips all around the world, just like in the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark, including to Tibet, especially to Tibet. And so there was this very famous mountaineer who is portrayed by Brad Pitt in the movie 7 Years in Tibet. And he came back in early 1938 with a cache of documents. And I'll tell you, James, the Germans couldn't prepare a trip to Antarctica faster than they did, because in that same year, they're heading down there to Neuschwabenland, where they claimed the land and they set up Base 211 in that trip. But they also went under the ice and started to make contact with the domain of the Ariane. And then they were given permission to set up New Berlin in that approximate same location. And I've also heard from researcher Terzinski that Albert Speer had all these grand designs for Berlin. Remember the schematics with the giant dome and all these other buildings around? They never got to build it in Berlin, Germany, but they built it in New Berlin, Neuschwabenland. So they did get their opportunity to build that futuristic city under the ice. And that's where the New Berlin base is. And I was actually able to locate a third location. So you got Base 211 on the surface, and then also under the ice near the Schumacher Ponds area. You got New Berlin, a science city under the ice near the South Pole. And then there's also the Thule Refuge, which is burrowed into the rock of a portion of Neuschwabenland. And you can see some of the entrances to the Thule Refuge on Google Earth. And it's really quite amazing. And I'm trying to find the picture here. But before I do, also that there are newspaper articles, this one from The Sun, of finding cities under the ice. So they're using the same kind of scanning technology that they used on the Giza Plateau about a year ago to find that whole giant under ice city there. And they're using it in Antarctica too, and finding grid-like patterns, even pyramids and other building-like structures under the ice. So the technology is now showing us that there had been not only ancient civilizations there, but perhaps even modern structures built under the ice in Antarctica.
How far is the crow flies is like Point McMurdo Station, for example, and I'm not sure that there's probably more American installations just citing the Americans than that by now. But yeah, give us an idea of how far McMurdo Station would be from some of the places you mentioned.
So McMurdo is the largest city in Antarctica, run by the Americans, and it's at McMurdo Sound on the coast. So it's about 700, 800 miles to the South Pole station, the Amundsen Scott South Pole Research Station, which is also run by the Americans. And then the third largest base run by the Americans is the Palmer Base, and that's way out on the Palmer Peninsula, the Antarctic Peninsula that I went to visit. This is the Antarctic Peninsula. And where I went and where Palmer Station is about right there. And I sailed all this area. But so, yeah, about 800 miles from McMurdo to the South Pole station, and almost all the supplies go there with cat tracks, snow cats, sort of like what you see grooming the mountains on ski resorts. They pull a whole train of supplies. So most of the supplies come overland from McMurdo to the South Pole station. And then further afield, where there are cat track trails and snowmobile tracks from the South Pole into the no-fly zone, which is also a no-entry zone. But Brian S. said he saw that there was like a road over the snow that went out to the hole in the ice. And get this, James, when it gets to the hole, it corkscrews down into the hole. So there's actually road access. And that's the same hole that Bird flew into. So there's air access. And it's the same location where the U-boats went. So you can get to this location by air, land, and sea.
So the best you can determine, at least by the late 1930s, the Germans had made a concerted effort to go to Antarctica and forge some kind of alliance with the beings there, the Germans and their whole Aryan, Thule Gesellschaft scheme of things, right? They probably saw them as ancestors or related in some way, and so. Do you think that it was at that point that they'd forged this program that enabled them to go off world, enabled them to do their own breakaway civilization even at that point?
Yeah, I would say it even started before then. It started with the Vril women right after World War I. They had started meeting in this Bavarian hunting lodge near Birch's Garden. And my friend Frank Jacob and his wife, girlfriend Tanya Metalford, they lived down there. And they said they found the hunting lodge. It's still there. It's not on any maps. It's kind of hard to find. But they got down there and they said it's still there. So these are the Vril women who wore their hair very long and they were telepathic. And so they were actually downloading telepathically these blueprints, like literal blueprints for zero point energy craft, which Victor Schellenberger said when he saw them that this is actionable intelligence. These are designs that we can take to the workshop and have our engineers craft some of this stuff. So by the early 1920s, they were already having blueprint designs to work from. And then in the 1930s, you have the famous UFO crash in the Black Forest in Germany in 1933. And then later, in the late 1930s, you had a nearly intact UFO craft that went down in the Lombardy region in Italy, and Mussolini turned over that craft to the German engineers. So they had been backward engineering this technology for, oh, about 2 decades before World War II even started. And then, of course, it accelerated. And by the time the war ended, though, when the Soviets got to some of these places where they were backward engineering and working on this technology, it was all gone. And all they found were a couple of the scientists with a bullet to the back of their head, probably because they refused to go to Antarctica with these artifacts. And so they had these giant U-boats that they could disassemble parts of these craft to take them down there to this science city. But it also went to portions in South America too, including this area of La Falda, where they had hollowed out a mountain. And it was even in the Lonely Planet that this was a UFO hotspot. So we went there and didn't overnight. We were going to do a night watch and see if we see anything on the mountain. We didn't. But in the Lonely Planet, it said, oh, yeah, all around this town, there are burn marks on the ground. There are people that were abducted, many, many sightings of craft coming in and out of this mountain. And so the Lonely Planet made it out to be some kind of UFO hotspot, but really what it was more akin to an Area 51 or an S4 location. Because I get back to the US and I'm telling my friend David Hatcher Childress, who's done several books on German technology and UFOs, he goes, "Brad, those weren't aliens, those are Germans." That's where they were testing their honeyboo craft and the Vril and stuff. He said, "Do you really think that a real alien UFO would leave burn marks or be so obvious about abducting people?" He's like, "No, this was all the Germans, and this is one of their underground bases in South America." Or as John Lear describes, a micronation, that the Germans, with all this wealth, they bought up these huge land holdings in Brazil and Chile and Argentina and created their own, basically their micronations, with the assistance of the fascist leaders like Juan Perón in Argentina at the end of World War II, and then Pinochet in Chile a decade later in the 50s and 60s. So they always had some kind of fascist dictator in one of the countries. So if Hitler needed to escape and from his redoubt in Bariloche, the movie or the TV series Hunting Hitler, they went to his Inalco house on the shores of the Natal Hulupi Lake, and they actually went ashore and they found the in a hangar where a seaplane could have been stored, and they found these vents for a large underground, deep underground military base that's there. So if the authorities were ever moving in on him, they could just jump in the seaplane, fly over the crest of the Sierras, and be in Chile within an hour or two. So they had a lot of options down there because they had all these leaders paid off.
You look at the uniforms some of the, the military juntas had down there, the Argentinians, the Chileans, they were wearing essentially German uniforms, everything, the helmets, the uniforms, etc. And it seemed to me, Brad, that just the way that you've described things and the way things kind of panned out, that the Third Reich had this exit strategy. Right? Because it must have dawned on some of the people. The German general staff was completely against the whole concept of fighting Europe and the West, and Hitler didn't want to fight England, really. They thought the real menace, of course, was the Bolsheviks coming from the East. So when it became obvious that they were going to lose continental Europe, they had this exit strategy mapped out, right? Because it always made me wonder why they didn't, they being the Germans, didn't focus on a Manhattan Project type effort with nuclear weapons, because they had all the brain power for all that. A lot of the early research was done. Otto Hahn, Fritz Strassmann, etc. They're the ones that came up with the idea of uranium fission. But the Americans and the British, their effort came out on top. But now it seems that all along, this effort had been underway to set up this redoubt that you're talking about, because they did have those long-range submarines. In fact, I would often wonder what would have happened if they didn't build all these capital ships like the Tirpitz and the Bismarck, which did no good whatsoever, and turned one of those battleships into 20 or so of these, super long-range submarines. Well, what might have happened? With the Battle of Atlantic, when you think about that. But anyway, take us to that through that process, because cinema fiction, quote unquote, has dropped hints over the years. There was that TV show years ago of the Germans having this base on Mars, not on Mars, but on the moon, right? And then there were other hints about that. Could you talk about that? Because now we're delving into the off-world aspects of it. Some of it may tie into, Joseph Farrell's great work, about the SS Bell and what have you. Again, the floor is yours.
Nazi International was another one of his books. I've met Joseph Farrell, fantastic researcher. Quote him in my book and all sorts of other documents that the Third Reich never surrendered at the end of World War II, nor did the SS. The fighting forces surrendered, the Wehrmacht, the Luftwaffe, and the Kriegsmarine. But indeed, the Germans were just cranking out the U-boats. Even in 1945, they made more U-boats in that year in which they surrendered in May than all the previous years combined. So I think they saw the writing on the wall, but unfortunately, it was a little too late for them because they did waste their time with surface ships, which really, as you said, didn't do much. But the U-boats were extraordinarily effective, including these large transport U-boats that could basically drop underwater outside the ports in Hamburg, which were not taken at the end of World War II, nor were the U-boat stations in Norway. All of those were still intact at the end of the war. And the last battle of World War II, which historians don't tell us because it was a rout for the Germans, was a U-boat battle in the North Sea, where they sunk a dozen or so Allied ships in what's known as the Führer convoy, when they're basically escaping with the last of the high-ranking generals who are allowed to escape, as well as much of the materiel. So we came across these passports, and you can see the top one is the Führer's convoy, and the others are passports to Neuschwabenland and Base 211. I mean, it's right there in their documents, because not just a whole bunch of materiel for the UFO craft left at the end of the war, but not just hundreds, but thousands of personnel have absolutely gone missing at the end of the war. No idea where they went. Same with over 100 U-boats that just disappeared. They know they manufactured them, they were given a number, but they were not ever sunk or known to their whereabouts. And even after the war, James, I think you'll probably remember a couple submarines had to surface. They had mechanical issues and showed up at La Plata, Argentina, where the Americans got them and interrogated the members and finally got it out of them, out of the captain, that they were part of the Führer's convoy, but had to make it to Argentina because, for whatever reason, they couldn't continue the trip or had made the trip and were heading back somewhere, and then they had mechanical difficulties and had to leave. So, yeah, that's really a big part of this story, is the U-boats and the transport and all the people that were coming out of there. And David Hatcher Childress, in his book, said that they had hundreds of women from Croatia who actually volunteered to go to Neuschwabenland, as well as several hundred women from the Ukraine, young, beautiful women who would be the brides of the scientists and soldiers. The last battalion that Hitler described, one of his last speeches in Germany, was describing the last battalion. And he said that they would be the fighting force, presumably for the Fourth Reich, that would defend their final holdings and colonies in these far-flung South American and Antarctica colonial states, because Germany needed new land. They were not like the British or the French or the Dutch or the Belgians, even, who took Belgian Congo and Africa. And, of course, the European powers had their colonies everywhere else. The Germans had very little overseas land. They were always a continental force. And so when they had the opportunity to set up shop in Antarctica and then set up these micronations in South America, it was a perfect solution for then getting people out. And a multi-generational society that existed in Antarctica. So there was a book that came out, an ebook, about 10 years ago that Carrie Cassidy for Project Camelot had translated, which was called New Berlin. And it was a German speaking person who was born there, but escaped and then wrote this book. And much of it was a technical manuscript. I mean, way very, very technical, kind of hard to read. But he did describe his life growing up in New Berlin and living under the ice his whole life until he got out. And then it was kind of like, wow, there's a whole world out here. So there's evidence that there's multi-generational Germans that still exist there, because also Linda Moulton Howe and Michael Sala reported that a couple of years ago, in the middle of winter, you get this dozen or so German-speaking people that arrived at McMurdo, and they said, "Get us out of here! Get us on the next flight! We got to leave!" And that was also the same time that Gene Decode was saying they were taking out the military bases and the tube tunnels connecting to South America, because right then at that same time, you have 10 kilometers down, 5.5 on the Richter scale, which Gene Decode says is the telltale sign for taking out a military base or tube tunnel. And they basically hit Antarctica. And so some of these survivors, wherever they came from, made their way to McMurdo and just said, "Get us out of here." So that was reported, yeah, by Linda Moulton Howe and Michael Sala from
Who do you
Exopolitics.
think was trying to take out, sections of that underground civilization or civilizations?
Well, the White Alliance. So it could be even our off-planet Solar Warden forces. Who are going up against the off-planet Nachtwaffen, which is the German super soldiers and the off-planet breakaway civilization of the Antarctic Germans. Now that they had their craft and the material and personnel down there, and then they were going off-planet. So this has been an uneasy truce ever since Operation High Jump, because right after High Jump, in which the Germans undoubtedly sent us packing and won that conflict. But then in July 1958, or 1952 rather, when Harry Truman was president, right before Eisenhower gets in, you have the overflight of the US Capitol. And here's a bunch of headlines from that incident. So at the time, a lot of people thought, oh man, the US is being invaded by aliens. No, it was these Germans that could fly from pole to pole at incredible speeds. And it wasn't just one flyover, James. It was also 4 days later they came back. And according to Laura Eisenhower's whistleblower, Dan Brown, who she's had several interviews with, and I've spoken to as well and questioned him. He said that we basically didn't necessarily surrender to the Antarctic Germans, but created an uneasy truce. Said, okay, we're not going to come back with high jump. We know you've got this high technology and you can fly over the most sensitive airspace in the country with these craft that can fly pole to pole at incredible speeds. So we're not going to attack you, but they weren't too happy about it either. And then it actually culminated in the final trip that Byrd went down there. His fifth trip to Antarctica is called Operation Deep Freeze. And Kerry Cassidy's whistleblower, Captain Mark Richards, said that they delivered a German UFO. Probably gave them one of the old early prototypes, landed on a aircraft carrier, and then they whisked it back, because that's all they wanted. They wanted the high technology that the Germans had. But there was still this uneasy truce. So in 1958, you have Operation Argus in the Southern Ocean, right off the shore of New Schwabenland, where they were doing these nuclear tests in the upper atmosphere. But ostensibly, I think they were nuking New Schwabenland, but again, to no effect, because they were so burrowed in and deep underground that nukes couldn't dislodge them. So, what's really interesting about all that is the very next year, you have the Antarctica Treaty come out and start to be ratified. And one of the very first provisions of the Antarctica Treaty is that there would be no nuclear testing or bombs detonated in Antarctica. It's like, why do you have to make that such an important statement unless it's already occurred? And so this uneasy truce continued even, well, through the Antarctica Treaty, which was ostensibly to protect the land holdings of the Antarctic Germans. And by the way, they don't like to be known as Nazis anymore. They're the Antarctic Germans, is their preference. And by the way, they also have an embassy. Tuzinski thinks it's in Washington, D.C., but I've heard other information that it's in New York City near the UN. It's an unmarked building, an unmarked elevator. You need a special key code to go up, and then you open up and you're in the embassy for the Antarctic Germans.
It's interesting. We hear so much about programs, the effort to get as much advanced German technology as possible. They've gone through various, project names, paperclip, overcast, what have you. And it seems to me, especially after what you've been saying, is that the Americans and the Brits, they were lucky to get away with the rocketry, the V1, the V2, technology. I mean, you talked about underground bases carved into the mountains of South America. There's the well-known underground base beneath the Harz Mountains where the V2 assembly plant was. So special units have been set up by the British and the Americans to go look for the blueprints, to go look for the technology, to find the technicians and the scientists and haul them back before the Russians got a hold of them, right? It was a mad scramble. And what was interesting was, like I said, the Americans made off with all the rocketry, but this effort had been going on with these Antarctic Germans affecting actual space travel. Now, the time we got left in the first segment, tell us what your thoughts are about the German off-world program, because just very quickly, one of my good friends who's since been assassinated, William Pollack. He was very well connected with a number of alphabet soup intelligence agencies because he was an electronic expert and a computer expert this way back in the day. So he'd been to places like Tonobot Test Range and Area 51. And he told me that there was an occasion when, they were all out of the tarmac and they were one of these secret bases and they were waiting for some big shot to come in, right? To fly in, and they were going to be there on the runway to greet the guy. They expected some big shot to come from DC, but the guy that got out of the plane was a German, right? And in one of the mind control, MILAB type operational training I went through, right? I went through this whole sequence where I was doing what people would call like room clearing, close quarter combat, etc. So I burst into a room. And this was like a big mansion that we were training in, what was simulated to look like a big mansion. I burst into this big room, big oak table, chandeliers, and I'm in the process of clearing out the place. But there's a guy that I refer to as the field marshal. He was standing there, an older guy, an old gentleman, and he looked like a World War II field marshal with a uniform, the field marshal jacket, and everything. And he starts talking to
German
me.
one?
What's that?
A German
A German
uniform?
guy, and he's speaking to me in a dialect. Now I can pick up high German, but when they start talking Bavarian, Schwabish, and Alemannish, it just like, it doesn't register for me, right? So he starts speaking in this dialect. I have no idea what he's talking about. I'm just barely picking up some of the things that he keeps talking and talking and talking. And the point of relevance is that even in my little corner of the multiverse, I get these stories, like my friend Dr. Carla Turner, who was likewise assassinated. People don't realize it was the aliens that bumped her off. It wasn't deep black military. However, when she was taken on board and the aliens began working on her, they put something onto her liver where she subsequently developed cancer. My other friend Marianne happened to be on board the ship at the same time and watch the aliens do this. And Marianne told me and told Barbara Bartholik that there was a human there and he was wearing a brown, the way it was described to me, it was one of those brown Nazi party uniforms like Martin Bormann used to wear. And he had like this red armband with the classic red background, the black swastika. And he was watching the aliens do this to Dr. Carla Turner. And he had this expression on his face of just utter sadness. Like there was nothing he could do. That what they were doing to Carla had to happen. And the German guy was just disconsolate because he couldn't do anything about it. But anyway, point being is that we keep getting these stories of these Germans mixed up with aliens and what have you. From your perspective, what types of aliens are these off-world Antarctic Germans involved with, and what seems to be the agenda?
Yeah, I've heard that a lot too, James, that abduction people would come back and say, yeah, there were gray aliens working on me, but off in the corner I'd see a uniformed German officer. And for a long time I kept thinking, what? What are they doing there? But it makes perfect sense that they allied themselves with the grays, who were basically, all grays are test tube babies. They're not born natural birth anymore. They've lost that ability to reproduce. So they just have to keep cloning themselves in new bodies. And they're basically the servants to the reptilians. So the Germans definitely made a bad treaty with the reptilians, and the Greys were basically their servants, would do their bidding. And so the reptilians donated to the Germans a base that they could take over in Antarctica. And that's where Base 211 went. They were given directions to a defunct reptilian base that they were able to initially set up shop and expand for their own purposes too. And keep in mind, all of those paperclip Nazis that came over here, many of them were working on the, it was called the Todt Project. It was the name of an officer with the last name Todt. And you can still see that on some of the bunkers in Fortress Europe and in France and elsewhere that call it Todt. And they came over here. He died in the war, but his minions who were working on those deep underground military projects, that all came from Nazi Germany. And you mentioned the Harz Mountains and Wernher von Braun. He was working with slave labor down there, working on his V1 and V2s, which were raining down on Britain. I mean, Wernher von Braun should have been in Nuremberg, held up on war crimes. But he's brought over here, and then he heads up NASA. So it's quite hypocritical that a lot of these guys got away with it and were given new lives, new identities in some cases. And many of the Manhattan Project scientists came out of Germany. And it's been said that if Germany had 6 more months, that they would have had the nuclear bomb. And they were already doing test runs. They had a plane that could leave Germany and fly all the way to New York City and back without refueling, and had already done a test run that they were going to nuke New York to sue for peace. And had they done that, they probably would have succeeded in getting America to back off. So then we get their scientists, they work on the Manhattan Project, then we nuke Japan, and they too surrender after that. And so when Admiral Byrd, and this is only the year following World War II and the end of the war in Japan, he was in his meeting with the master told that on no uncertain terms are we to stop our nuclear testing and nuclear programs. And he was told to go back to the Pentagon and tell the high officials, no more nukes. Of course, that fell on deaf ears, and they did not follow those instructions. But it just goes to show how important this nuclear testing and these scientists were at the end of the war. And as you said, we got the lion's share. A few of them were captured and did go to the Soviet Union, and some of them went to Britain as well. But we got the lion's share of the think tank out of Germany at the end of the war because a lot of them wanted to surrender to the US. Even Wernher von Braun made the effort to surrender only to the Americans.
And also, his colleague, General Walter Dornberger, wound up working for the U.S. Army and had a role in the development of the Army Missile Development Agency there in Huntsville, Alabama. But anyhow, we've reached the end of a fascinating first segment. Brad, can you tell our viewers and listeners how they can find your work?
Yeah, sure. If you want to follow me and some of the projects I'm working on, go to bradolson.com, just as my name spelled. And there I have my conference schedule. And I've got already a dozen conferences booked in this year. You want to check out my book or several other authors at cccpublishing.com. And if you order one of my books, then you can get a signed copy. And I also did the whole series of books on esoteric subjects, which many of these include information about the Germans and their high technology that all parlayed into Secrets of Antarctica. So those are the two places to check out my work or be in touch.
For our viewers and listeners out there, if you like what we do, if you believe in what we do here at the Cosmic Switchboard, please go to our website, sign up, and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next segment.